Sun's Weekend All. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the February 11th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. The energetic Andy Edwards has been talking this week with Dave McGillivray, the race director of the Boston Marathon, the world's oldest annual marathon. First run in 1897 is usually held in April, but this year it's scheduled for October 11th because of the global coronavirus pandemic. But that date is contingent on big road races with tens of thousands of runners being allowed as part of the reopening plan in the northeast U.S. state of Massachusetts. Boston Marathon race director Dave McGillivray has taken an active role in coordinating efforts to deliver the COVID-19 vaccine to thousands of people in Massachusetts. In the first part of their conversation, Dave told Andy how his event company is helping vaccinate thousands of people at two big Boston area sports venues, Fenway Park, the home of Major League Baseball's Boston Red Sox team, and Gillette Stadium, home of the National Football League's New England Patriots team. This evening, Dave tells Andy, it was very difficult to see the Boston Marathon canceled for the first time last year because of the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, a number of years ago, we were faced with extreme heat. And people said to me, oh, you'd never cancel the Boston Marathon. And I said, you want to bet? I mean, if it was 130 degrees, we'd have to cancel it. It's too dangerous, right? But I never really in my own gut ever felt like, how could you ever cancel the Boston Marathon? And last year came, and ultimately, that's what we did. And we ran a virtual last year, and we had 18,000 people register for that. So there's still that connection, and people understand. And so this year, you know, we're hopeful. There's no guarantee. We're hopeful. But we're also understanding that we need to be flexible. And as we get closer and closer, we're going to continue the plan. But as we get closer, if it shows that it's just not safe to do it, then we won't do it. And we'll do a virtual again. But if it's safe to do it, we'll move forward. And there is that concept of a hybrid where we could do a little of both, you know, have an in-person for a certain subset of, you know, the running population, and then also offer the virtual for those people who aren't able to get in.
Let's bring the focus a little closer to Boston. And as I said to you, I've commentated from afar on international TV feeds of the race live, but that one time, 1988, when Ibrahim Hussein won for Kenya the men's title and was a motto of Portugal. And I have the books by Tom Derderian, who's a well-known American writer and journalist, behind me in my library. So all that was part of my preparation and knowledge. And being in Boston 32 years ago, I was so struck about how distinctive the history the course of Boston is, you know, a tough, tough course, and that descent, which means that, as it is, you'll never have officially a world record. But people like Rob Di Castella, the 1987 world champion in the marathon from Australia, saying something like, a quote, his legs felt so battered coming down off the Newton Hills. So if we just pick out a couple of aspects of the Boston course, for a start, it's historic. Then you go through kind of a quintessential aspect of New England, I think. You know, when people talk about all the noise through Wellesley College, I mean, just give them, for those, a lot of our audience are in Africa, but also beyond Africa, Wellesley College, what's special about that and the noise there?
Yeah, I've always felt that every marathon has its own, what I call, character. And for us, you know, we're the oldest continuous running marathon in the world, and it was basically created on the heels of BAA members going to Athens and running in the Athens Marathon Olympic Games back in 1896 or whatever it was. And so it's a point-to-point, and held on a Monday versus a weekend day. Very unique, very different. It started at noontime, mainly because the only way to get out to the start in Hopkinton is to take the train, and the train only arrived there at like 11 o'clock, so you couldn't start it any earlier, and all kinds of unique features. Certainly, the downhill is the sort of part of the course that is the most challenging, believe it or not, because people usually aren't that prepared to run that much downhill, 400 feet in elevation drop. So they get, as Rob said, beat up along the way. So from the beginning to the Newton Hills, it's a lot of downhill. So by the time you get to the Newton Hills, you're fried. And so the people who run this course the best are people who know the course. So it isn't just the shape you're in that day. It's two things: knowing the course, so the strategy of how to run, but also training on a course that has topography similar to Boston to prepare and acclimate your body to such, extreme downhill. But yeah, it's the only major metropolitan marathon that actually runs through more residential community than it does city streets. It's called the Boston Marathon, but only 2.6 miles of the Boston Marathon is in Boston. So yeah, you start off in Hopkinton and go through, Ashland and Framingham and Natick, and finally you come to the halfway point in Wellesley with the Wellesley College women out there with signs and yelling and screaming and the tunnel and all that, and then you make your way to Newton and then the infamous hills, going up to Heartbreak Hill and cresting that, and Boston College, and come down off those hills and turn onto Beacon Street, and finally making your way past Fenway Park and the Citgo sign, and right on Hereford, left on Boylston, and crossing the finish line right there in front of the John Hancock Tower. So there's a lot of unique aspects of the course that people, as they're running, they go, okay, I made it this far. Okay, I went by Wellesley College and the women. Okay, I made it to this, and then they check it off along the way. And so it's just a really unique experience that makes this the holy grail of marathoning throughout the world.
That's a lovely way to put it, the Holy Grail. And I think history, if you're a sports fan and a participant, it can mean so much. I mean, I think when I started running 40 odd years ago and more, reading about Bill Rogers, Boston Billy, I mean, you picked up that point of people who know the course. From what I remember, again, his autobiography is on my shelves. He was living in Boston. And when he won the race in 1975, he had that kind of hand stenciled, like a felt tip marker pen on a t-shirt, Greater Boston Track Club. And he'd been training on that daily. And then you also earlier, don't you, you had Clarence DeMar in the 1930s winning Boston seven times. And that's what makes these events special, isn't it? It's fast times, wonderful champions, but also a sense of history.
Without a doubt. And for those of us living around here in the early years, there were a lot of local champions like Johnny Kelly Sr., Johnny Kelly the Younger, Billy Rogers, Joan Benoit Samuelson, Alberto Salazar, Greg Meyer. A lot of these folks grew up in this area, and it was really fun to watch the Boston Marathon with all these international runners, but the local homegrown hero ends up winning. And it's just such a thrill to witness that, and Billy to win it four times, and Joni a couple of times, and all that. So yeah, just that history is really what draws people to Boston every year.
Well, Dave, you're a busy man. I'm very grateful for such a fascinating insight. We wish you and your colleagues all the best. And it's a funny thing, this pandemic and lockdown has made a lot of us think, well, what do I really want to do in life when things get back together, and what's important to me? And one of the things I want to do is definitely go back and cover, as a journalist, races around the world that I've covered. And I thought, yeah, I want to go back and be a reporter in Boston. And not least, 30 odd years ago, I still remember how good that Boston clam chowder soup tasted. So I hope one day we can meet, not virtually, but as reporter and US race director. All the best to your colleagues, Dave, and thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you, Andrew, and I've always felt, just like after the bombing in 2013, that the comeback will always be stronger than the setback, and such will be the case for all of us getting through this pandemic together.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we can all help fight the corona pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and nose when we are in crowded places or areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. An 8-year-old Ghanaian boy is dreaming of becoming a chess grandmaster after winning an African youth tournament. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, Yao Afusu-Larbi in Accra tells us more. Sporty greetings, Yao.
Sporty greetings, Sunny. Dave has had his eyes on a chessboard since he was 4. He was introduced to it by his father, David, who teaches chess in schools across the capital. David's impact can easily be felt on his son. In their bookshelf at home, books of the game dominate the ranks. His trophies and certificates are also a major feature in the living room. On the chessboard, he glides through every square, picking up pawn after pawn, knights and rooks, all in a bid to be the first to lock the game up in a checkmate.
Chess is a mind game. It makes me think, and I also like the tactics that people use to win.
When you were playing the tournament, the one you just won, what was the experience like for you?
Everybody played very well. It was difficult at some points, but it was a good tournament.
What do you dream of anytime you play chess?
To become a grandmaster.
Okay.
And also increase my rating in everything I do in chess.
Dave says he gets his inspiration from Magnus Carlsen, the Norwegian chess grandmaster who is currently the world chess champion and wants to be like him when he is much older.
It happens when white plays e4, mm-hmm. Black plays c5,
right.
Knight f3, d6, mm-hmm. d4, and every time play the Sicilian, d4 is likely to happen.
Right.
And every time he plays d4, you always have to take on d4.
Okay.
And the reason is that you are taking a central pawn.
Right.
This is the center, and the pawn is in the center, so you are taking a central pawn.
Yeah.
So after you castle, 3 pawns are in front of your king, and now nobody can attack it. Okay. So now black can also do the same thing.
Okay.
There he is, trying out the Sicilian defense in chess so effortlessly. He is only 8 years, but his points total at his age has already surpassed what many grandmasters were able to achieve when they were like him. He has just won the Africa Under-9 online chess competition after scaling past 104 others. His father is a proud man.
Very, very excited to get him to hear that, to when he won. In fact, we knew he would do well. Because I can always tell the strength of other kids, you know, online. I can see how strong the field is. So I knew definitely he will, maybe the top 5 will be there. Winning the continental champion, he's getting a trip to Greece to play in the world event, and that is where we'll be meeting a much, much tougher opponent. And so we are preparing towards that. But it calls for more robust training, if possible. If you can even get a grandmaster to train him at this stage, that would be excellent. And all these come at a cost. And so one will appeal to all well-meaning Ghanaians, corporate bodies, to begin to look at supporting a game like chess.
Dave is not the only offspring in his young family who is passionate about the sport. His brother, Jedidiah, who he is much older than, is breathing down his neck. Dave and his brother have seen The Queen of Katwe, and it is a movie they both claim has shot up their level of interest in the board game. Like Fiona Mutesi, all he thinks about is to become the best. The best here, the best on the continent, and the best in the world. The stakes are high, but Dave, with his father by his side, are ready to conquer the world one chess game at a time. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Yao Fusilabi in Accra.
Hi, this is Press Conference USA guest host Kim Lewis. Join me and VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins as we discuss the great migration of African Americans with author and historian Jesse Holland. We'll discuss how it shaped the political, social, and cultural landscape of America. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
Hello, Jonathan Mensah here, Black Stars defender and Columbus Crew captain. You are listening to The Sunside of Sports on Voice of America.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings, where we feature music and interviews along with your favorite artists from around the world. Tune in and interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Shirin.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Good. How are you tonight? Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT.
Thanks, Larry. That's Larry London, a man who's always ready to cross musical borders. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers celebrated their Super Bowl title Wednesday with a boat parade. Thousands of fans lined the Hillsborough River near downtown Tampa, Florida. The Buccaneers beat the Kansas City Chiefs Sunday 31-9 to win Super Bowl 55 in Tampa. At one point during the parade, Tampa Bay's star quarterback Tom Brady was captured on video tossing the Super Bowl's Lombardi trophy from his boat across the water to a shirtless Rob Gronkowski in another boat. That brought wild cheers from fans and players. Brady threw two touchdown passes to Gronkowski during the Super Bowl, and the two players connected numerous times when they played for the New England Patriots. Meanwhile, Sunday's Super Bowl drew an audience of more than 96 million television viewers here in the United States, as we hear now from the AP's Oscar Wells Gabriel.
96.4 million viewers. That is how many people checked out the big game on Sunday. But CBS is reporting that the big story of the game isn't how many people watch, but how they watched. The number includes a record digital audience. The network says the title match was the most live-streamed NFL game ever, averaging 5.7 million viewers per minute. That is up 65% from last year. This year's Super Bowl is also the first NFL game to deliver more than a billion total streaming minutes. The most watched Super Bowl ever was in 2015. The matchup then between the New England Patriots and Seattle Seahawks drew 114.4 million viewers. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Thanks, David. That's David Vandy, the host of the VOA's African Beat music show. On the tennis beat, defending women's champion Sofia Kenin of the USA crashed out of the Australian Open Thursday. Craig Gabriel reports from Melbourne.
Defending a major, one of the four most important tournaments tournaments in the world is never easy, irrespective of how many times you may have done it. You only have to ask the likes of Roger Federer, Serena Williams, or Rafa Nadal, or Novak Djokovic. It's not like just any other tournament. So when it's the first time, the task is even harder. And for American Sophia Kenin, it seemed like she'd begun climbing Everest. Kenin won the Australian Open 12 months ago, and now she was looking up at the summit as nerves continued to envelop her. She pretty much talked herself out of the task, and it resulted in her losing to Kaya Kanepi 6-2, 6-3. To say she was a basket case with anxiety would be an understatement. She was left in floods of tears.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I haven't experienced that, and I obviously felt like I'm not there 100%, you know, physically, mentally, my game, everything just feels like really off, obviously. It's not good. I mean, I know I couldn't really, I guess, handle the pressure, you know. I'm not obviously used to this, so right now, what's on my mind, I just got to figure out how to, you know, play at that level that I played at.
This second round loss is the earliest for an Australian Open women's defending champion since Jennifer Capriati lost in the first round in 2003. World number one, Ash Barty, was given some trouble in the second set, but she got past compatriot Daria Gavrilova 6-1, 7-6.
I haven't played a lot of tennis over the last 12 months, so obviously you're going to have ebbs and flows, not only in your concentration, but of your level of play as well. But it's important to be able to bring that back as often as possible. And just for a couple of games there, I wasn't able to do that. But a much better game at 5-6 to be able to reset, kind of go from there again, and then push it towards a tiebreak, which again was tight, but some of the misses were better misses in a way. Of trying to do the right thing.
Karolina Pliskova and Elena Svitolina had wins, as did Belinda Bencic, who was taken to three sets. Daniil Medvedev was too good, as were his compatriots Andrei Rublev and Karen Khachanov. The Italians put on a show, but not for the right reasons for two of them. Fabio Fognini and Salvatore Caruso ended up in fisticuffs when Fognini rallied from 1-5 in the fifth to win. Who said tennis could be boring? Stefanos Tsitsipas won a five-set thriller over Aussie Thanasi Kokkinakis, who's making a comeback after injuries and illness. Craig Gabriel for VOA Sports, Melbourne.
Who said tennis could be boring, Craig? We're enjoying your reports from Melbourne. They're certainly not boring. And American star Serena Williams is not boring either when it comes to her tennis, as well as her outfits on the court. Serena says with one of her outfits in Melbourne, she's taken inspiration from Florence Griffith Joyner, a.k.a. FloJo, the late American track star. Talk to us, Serena!
Actually, this outfit was last minute, to be honest. It was, I just felt like the design that we had before was an S Serena-esque. And so the Nike team went back and created something very Serena-like. Didn't have time to put it in retail, so it was definitely more of a last-minute outfit than usual, so... It's light. It's actually, if you look up close, it's actually breathable, and it's perforated, so it's actually super light.
Serena Williams, at the age of 39, is bidding for her record-tying 24th major singles title in Melbourne. That would put her equal with the now-retired Australian Margaret Court. Seven of Serena's major singles championships have come in Melbourne, with her last title in 2017 when she beat her older sister, Venus, in the final. And Serena Williams will be back on the court Friday when she plays a third-round match against the Russian Anastasia Potapova. VOA's Gwen Uden joins us now with a report on the Australian Open tournament director, who was born in Durban, South Africa. Sporty greetings, Gwen!
Sporty greetings, Sonny. The 2021 Australian Open is one of the first major sporting events to host crowds and international athletes since the coronavirus outbreak began. A maximum of 30,000 spectators have been allowed to gather inside Melbourne Park over the first 8 days of the event, reduced to 25,000 fans once the quarterfinals begin. Australian Open Tournament Director Craig Tiley tells Reuters News while he believes COVID-19 will have a lasting impact on elite sports, he thinks the biggest changes will affect the fans themselves.
The biggest change that's going to come for sports entertainment is the apprehension people have to participate. If you charge a premium price, you're going to have to get a premium experience. And the premium experience, the first question is going to be, how safe it is. And if there's a community spread in the virus, if there's, you know, more spread of the virus in the community, it's not safe. People are going to stay at home. So I think buying your own car and driving your own car, sitting in your own theater at home, enjoying your own content at home is going to be much more a thing of the future than it is today, even more so. So our challenge as a sport is how do we bring people from that environment, which is now more entrenched in, to an environment where we still want to get them to come out and enjoy the content we can put in front of them in a live way.
This year's tournament was postponed by 3 weeks from its usual start date in mid-January, leaving Craig Tiley with the daunting task of staging the event during the global pandemic. But amid doubts the tournament would take place at all, many believe the South African-born director would be the one to pull it off. Tiley is the current CEO of Tennis Australia, the sport's governing body, and has led the Australian Open tournament for the past 15 years. He's recognized as one of Australia's most innovative and forward-thinking chief executives in the sport. And Tiley says this year has taught him the importance of cooperation in leadership.
I think the type of leadership that's going to be required more than ever before is one of great cooperation and great integration of teams and skills and capability of other people. Because more than ever before, the intensity and the risk that's involved with accomplishing goals that you set forward will only be achieved through a wide and large group of people working hand in hand, because it can no longer be done by a single individual. But the one of great cooperation and of great integration and utilizing the capability and skills of a much broader team is the one that's going to win. And so that's the one thing I think is going to change more than before, which is great because it's going to be more value-based leadership, more empathetic leadership, and more appreciation for our environment and more appreciation for people's health and well-being. And I think the bad things that people get away with hopefully are now more focused on by the community and more actions taken to prevent it.
Tiley says under his leadership, he hopes the Australian Open will return to its usual 2-week slot in January 2022. But he warns that would mean the quarantine process will have to start in December.
What we are going to plan for is quarantine program, a different date, because currently we've been pushed a month forward as an event, so we want to come to a month back in January. So get back to our original dates, quarantine in December. In more crowds, but in a much more digitally friendly and safe way, or new way, I should say. It's safe currently now, but they're continuing with those protocols. I don't see physical distancing and the wearing of masks and the quarantine going anytime soon.
One change Tiley predicts for the future of the sport is that technology will replace line judges in professional tennis. And he offered a bit of advice.
I was actually talking to a friend yesterday who's a line judge. And he asked me, he said, do you think my career is over? And I said, as a line judge, yes. At the professional levels, at the lower levels, no, because there'll still be work at the lower levels. But as a chair umpire or a review official, those will be very much needed, and there'll be high demand for those. There'll be higher paying jobs, but there'll be high demand for them, and the skill capability will be higher. So if that's one you want a career in officiating tennis, that's the direction to go.
Words of wisdom from tennis director turned career advisor Craig Tiley. The Australian Open is now underway in Melbourne and is scheduled to conclude on February 21st. And that is all from me, Sonny. Back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten.
Hi, I'm Francis Tiafo. You're listening to Sunny Side of Sports on Voice of America.
American tennis player Francis Tiafo lost a tough second round match Wednesday at the Australian Open to world number one Novak Djokovic. Defending champion Djokovic, bidding for a 9th Australian Open trophy, won in 4 sets. Edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington.